Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are one of more than a couple of dozen lodges around the world, and we are autonomous of the others. The one thing that we share in common is the declaration that you'll find on the back of the periodical guide. This is literally everything about the lodge in terms of volunteerism, philosophy, and the modus operandi for us. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Those few short, magnificent paragraphs are what the students here in Philadelphia center their lives on, associate themselves through their volunteer work, and hold very dear. Everything that you see around you in this facility is supported by time, energy, service, donations of money. If you would like to volunteer in some way to help sustain the effort, whatever that may be, please talk to the individual at the book table. Here in Philadelphia, in keeping with the declaration, we hold 2 public presentations per week. On Sunday mornings, such as today, the building opens at 10:30. There's always someone available at the book table in the foyer to answer questions or to help you look at straight-line publications that you might want to purchase for home use. But to be perfectly honest, that individual can also point you toward websites where those publications are offered freely. The information offered in Theosophy, in ULT, is the birthright of every single human being anywhere in the world, and therefore no profit can be made on the publications that are offered. The Sunday talks begin promptly at 11 and at 12. And we are in a new month with a new theme, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Wednesdays, the building is also hopping with activity. At 5:15, the building is open, and anyone that wants to come in and look through hard copies of straight-line theosophical books, magazines, etc., can find assistance from students who volunteer their time to help people with research. It's a reference library. It is not a lending library, but it's a very high-quality library, and there are very sincere students offering their time and energy to assist. During the library period from 5:15 to 7:15, you can also Check with the book table if you're trying to make a home purchase of any kind. Wednesday nights at 7:30, the class begins. It's a more informal presentation on theosophy. This winter, we're repeating a cycle of studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. The class is open to everyone that would like to come in and hear these ideas, and that class lasts from 7:30 to 8:30. Now, having said that, it is happy December. How it got to be December already, I don't know, but here we are in a whole new month with a whole new theme. In December this year, we're looking at an umbrella topic of cycles and cyclic law. Next December 10th, next Sunday, the title is Dreams and the Dreamer. This morning, the two panelists that you see before you have been assigned a topic called The Cycles of Death and Rebirth. And again, this is a way of looking at something that is universal and extremely natural, but something that can be studied from a variety of angles, high and low. So without further ado, we'll start. In terms of my presentation, it's a great way to kick off the month to think about the universals and to think about the macro cycles of death and rebirth, if you will. Those of you who have been studying the philosophy or attending classes for a little while know that the second aspect of the one eternal truth, that second fundamental, is one of periodicity, of law, of cause and effect. Universally, then, the principle or the idea of cycles in general and psychic law governs everything from the cosmological roots of manifestation all the way down to the most finite existence on this particular planet. And certainly if you think about the images that we've got of the birth of a cosmos or the emanation of what happens when there's an emanation that arises within the absolute and then becomes manifest, we often in religious scriptures see words like the word was or let there be light, so that in this context, in this idea of fundamental periodicity, there's a vibration of force, and that vibration, that emanation of force that arises and then manifests itself is available to us in so many different ways for us to consider. Light, sound, electricity, magnetism. And when we're considering this universal abstract motion of cycles, an eternal cycle, we often use symbology of the sine curve and in the human kingdom, certainly, the spiral. But the sine curve, that wiggly snake-like curve that goes up and down across an axis, is something that represents every single degree of rest and activity, death and rebirth. We see it in a variety of aspects of great nature, and certainly we can use what we observe in great nature to experience the second fundamental of periodicity, cause and effect, or cycles, and then begin to consider the nature of death and rebirth. We can observe it in what astronomers can now picture with instrumentation, with the emergence or what looks like the birth of a star, the gradual duration of that star, and the death of the star. We can use archaeological evidence and all sorts of scientific investigations to explore the changing face of the planet on which we live. We are offered in the philosophy a very interesting statement about the life force of the globe. Theosophically speaking, the Earth is said to be an entity, conscious in its own right in a certain manner, and that there are life forces. There are periods of rest and then periods of life and expression akin to death and rebirth in the natural physical cycles of the Earth. So at this time of year, coming up at the solstice, we see the illusion of the deciduous trees going into a death cycle or a period of passivity or inactivity or rest. And then we know that from January through to the spring solstice, we've got this gradual rising up of energy at every level in and around the entities of the Earth, and that gradually then there's a renewal, a new expression of life, again, a rebirth in the spring. So we can observe all that. We can observe that process of birth, growth, maturation and bloom, and then gradual decline and death in any number of ways. Forest fires and what happens thereafter when the forest is replenishing itself. Volcanic eruptions like Mount St. Helens, where in the decades after there's this remarkable, not reconstruction, but reanimation, if you will, of the vicinity. Another thing that we can observe in nature with life and death, which probably is a wonderful thing to ponder when we begin to think about human life, is the life cycle of a monarch butterfly. The recent explorations with the monarch butterflies, where this metamorphosis of the caterpillar into a cocoon or chrysalis, and folks that have opened up those chrysalis find very much little more than fluid. The entire caterpillar disappears into what looks like a puddle of potential life. And we know that what emerges from that chrysalis is an entirely different animal form, a rebirth that's incredibly significant, and that there's now research that what the caterpillar learned, despite this puddling of death that goes on in the chrysalis, the butterfly emerges with that same degree of knowledge. And that's pretty fascinating, very mysterious to this student. But throughout all, we see at the universal level of the cosmos, we see at all degrees of great nature, these cycles of death and rebirth, and there are great lessons to be had. But certainly re-embodiment in the lower kingdoms is not to be confused with what goes on in the cycles of the human kingdom.
Well, in the human kingdom, we also have a universal bloom. We have spirit, mind, and matter. And we have will also. And the connecting link between, actually, spirit and matter are two poles of one and the same thing. There's just periodically spirit manifests matter, and when we're living in this illusion called life, because it is a very illusory state, but it's a necessary illusion for the evolution of soul. So we have also that Fohat, which is cosmic energy. It's cosmic electricity. It's that mysterious link between mind and matter. And if we're not mistaken, we think will is also related to Fohat, because it's a very mysterious power, the human will. So we come forth periodically, well, and then we die. But we do not die. Physically, these bodies, these forms, go back into the ground. We are told that cremation is a good idea because it kind of speeds up our afterlife. It's kind of speeds up the process. And it also helps our loved ones behind, it actually helps them to move on with their lives a little more smoothly, a little smoother transition. When we die, the higher three principles separate from the lower four principles. So we are eternally spirit, mind, and soul. And then periodically, we have the astral body, which is the real body, the design body, on which our body is formed. And it interpenetrates and extends to a certain distance from our physical body. So it's kind of like the mango fruit. It's all intertwined. And it's kind of difficult sometimes to eat mangoes, but they are delicious. So the principles start to separate on death, the human principles. So once we've had the bloom of our existence, we could say, and then we go into decline and death on the physical stage, we have immediately afterwards, we have a review, which can take place instantaneously, but we're told to leave the body alone for 12 hours, just to be very respectful of the dead and not to be talking or showing any grief if you can. I mean, of course, that's a tough one there. But it's good to leave the body as undisturbed as possible and as peaceful a state as possible so that the afterlife review can take place. And even if a person is drowning, though, they can get the whole life review instantaneously. The entire life, all your dreams, everything you said, everything you observed, and things that you really didn't even catch that were on the periphery, because they're all part of the picture of the life last lived. So the astral form, there's a second death of the astral, but first we go into a state called Kamaloka, which is the place of desires, and this is where all of the lower lives are, the selfish, separative things, and are, you know, the dross. It's the easiest way to say it is the dross is sloughed off, and the next stage after the second death is death of the astral. Is going into the devakonic state. Devakon meaning the place of the gods in Sanskrit. So that's when our highest aspirations, our hopes and our dreams, not only for ourselves, but for maybe even more importantly, all those that we loved, we will see them as perfect and as realizing all their potentials to their fullest. Because it's a rest from earth life. It's a necessary rest and assimilation. And then when we come back into rebirth, we come back energized, and we get a preview. It's a sketch. It's not like the past life review. We see what our life path is to be, and we can... We see that it is just and it is fair, because with karma and reincarnation, karma meaning strictly action, everything we do, we say, we think, they all, on the thought plane, it's all energy, it's all thought. Thoughts are things. So we get a sketch of the life to live, the life to be lived, and we are at one. We are omniscient, in a sense, for that brief period of time. We see all the past, we see the future, and we know everything to be fair. So then we reincarnate into a family, and hopefully there's a whole other discussion about how you might not get the perfect vehicle that you want, but that's for private study, we think. So... we come into a family, a race, a nation, where we are connected, where we meet those that we knew in the past, that we've done work with in the past, that we've been at odds with in the past, and then we come into our present life now. We are reborn, we are reincarnated. But death, it's an illusion, and it's a change in the states of consciousness. Just like with the death of planets and the death of, we studied the rounds and races and globes recently, and we do that because we look at the analogy that these are all states of consciousness, and the quest for perfection, that the amount of perfectibility that is possible up to a certain limit, because life is illimitable. It has always existed. Nothing is created or destroyed, but the states of consciousness do change. The states of seeing, clear seeing, like clairvoyance and clairaudience, these are coming to the fore now more and more as we transition, as we evolve, because we're in basically the most solid type of matter now, although we have been evolving as spirit and matter meets at a certain point, and it's at equilibrium. And in the human form, it is in equilibrium. But we are on the ascendance spiritually, and it might not seem that way because we live in a age called the Kali Yuga, which is the dark age, and it's the most difficult age, and also changes are so rapid. They're four times as fast as they are in a golden age. Very rapid change, very difficult to deal with for many, especially if you're not equipped. But these ideas, they bring hope, and it's mercy and hope and justice, that reincarnation is part of the law of cycles. And the cycles of nature we see in man, we're affected by the cycles. We're affected by, if after 3 days of sunny weather, which has been happening fairly frequently lately, and nice moderate temperatures, it's just amazing how many people are in a good mood. It seems like everywhere you go, people are in a good mood. So we are affected by the weather. We're affected by circumstances. We're affected by all of nature. We're affected by what we ingest into our bodies, because we embody all the lower kingdoms in our body. We have the mineral, the vegetable, the animal. But we grow in the human stage by self-induced and self-devised means. We are fully self-conscious, or we are self-conscious. We're not omniscient. But we are self-conscious, and we're responsible for our choices. The lower kingdoms grow by natural impulse. In a sense, they're all hardwired or pre-programmed to act as they do. They have consciousness. They learn, and there's amazing things that animals can learn, but they're not responsible for their choices, but we are. So we have the cycle of birth, youth, manhood, decay, and death, morning, noon, night, which is followed by morning, spring, summer, autumn, winter, followed by winter again, and then we have emanation, preservation, destruction, and that brings on regeneration. And usually it's put forth as it's creation, preservation, destruction. But in a sense, nothing really is created or destroyed. It emanates. So at this time, your questions and comments are invited. In the back there?
You spoke of ages. The golden age, the dark age. Have we been evolving through how many ages is there in total?
Well, there's four ages there's four yugas make a Mahayuga or a great yuga, and that's 320 million years, which is a long time. But to us, it's a long time. But in eternity, even that is the wink of an eye. We're so governed by the clock and by time and by the seasons, and that, you know, we think about time as being real, but time just exists for the succession for evolution and consciousness. But yeah, we are in a dark age right now. It is the shortest of the four ages. There's the gold, the silver, the bronze, and the Iron Age. It's a Kali Yuga. Kali means black or dark in Sanskrit. So we now live in the Iron Age, where they're much more difficult. But yet the lessons are learned quicker, and the progress can be made quicker. So we're given a challenge, but we're supposed to step up to the plate. In the back.
In your presentation, you said that human life was illusionary. What do you mean by that?
Did I hear a voice here? I'm not sure. Oh, okay. Oh, are you real? human life is illusionary. Well, in a sense, it has to be illusionary. Everything is a reflection. Matter, spirit reflects itself in matter. And at the scene of a crime, there could be seven witnesses, but when the lawyers get a hold of you in the witness box, you get so many different stories, so many conflicting stories. Spirit is real and matter is real. They're both two parts of the one and the whole. But perhaps my cohort up here can
the cohort, the dreaded cohort,
can elaborate a little more on that.
Well, what just came to mind was that if we compare the animal kingdom and the human kingdom, in the animal kingdom, there is a sense of hunger and needing to eat for the preservation of life or for the feeding of young. And that's it. There's no major story behind it. There's no major frill of any kind. You don't find an Epicurean lion. They're not going to pursue a particular recipe. They don't look at a banquet in a particular way as a celebration. But the illusion comes in with the thinking and the desires of soul in the human state. So we take the notion of eat to live and flip it into live to eat. And much of life could be talked about in that fashion. When we think about this title, for instance, The Cycles of Death and Rebirth, death, it was listed first. For most thinkers in the modern world, the story they tell themselves, the illusion that is created, is that death is the final stage and that's it. There's a sempiternity, there's nothing more, and therefore it should come last. Philosophically, in the light of theosophy, we look at this as death is the end of a particular stage and an invitation of a harvest, if you will, for stages that will come again. So in that way, there's a lot of illusions.
That's much better. Mm-hmm. And we were looking at our notes here, and so another way to look at it is that we are not our bodies, because we observe changes in our bodies throughout our entire lives. We see the changes. We're not our minds. We can change our minds. We are not these feelings, these actions, these emotions. The only thing that is constant is the I. And if we lose our memory, if we become if we get amnesia, we know that I am I. That's the one thing that stays with us.
We made the same question when we first started coming to meetings about how can this be, how can the body be an illusion? I mean, I can touch it, it feels pain, different temperatures, so how can something like that be an illusion? And the way it was expressed to me is that basically anything that is illusion is an illusion is transitory.
Is what?
Transitory.
Because it's just not here all the time. So we found that to be a very easy explanation, which mainly leaves the higher.
And the body is a tool that we use during our conscious states to experience, observe, record, communicate with each other. But we know, and next Sunday we will get into the fact that when that body is put to rest for a nap or a deep sleep, life and consciousness and the ability to express existence continues on despite the apparent inactivity of the physical frame.
And also we recently, in the Ocean of Theosophy, on Wednesday nights, we are studying about, there's something called a Nitya Pralaya, which is a constant coming and going. It's everything is always in motion. And that the cell itself is an illusion, that there's like an electromagnetic force field called the privative limits of the cell, which keeps the illusion together. And to us, it's all very real. It's all very solid. And although we are in the most solid stage of matter, when we are in more ethereal stages, things will seem just every bit as much as real and solid then. This gentleman has his hand up.
Well, we've heard the statement, go to nature if thou wouldst know. And if we sit in the window and look out any time of the year, we see that, well, it's divided into seasons, spring, summer, winter, fall, winter, and it repeats itself continually. And if we concentrate on the different forms we see, the colors of the flowers, the trees, and so forth, we are the observer because we are self-conscious human beings. Whereas when we go out to nature, we see divided into different levels of consciousness. So when we begin to stop and think, and we hear the words, help nature in her cyclic course, then it must have a great deal of importance that we are human beings. What is the difference between human beings in nature and say the plant or the tree or the beast or even sand on the beach? Is there a difference?
If we postulate that there is one absolute, infinite, indescribable source of all life, all consciousness, and that everything in manifestation, every single form, represents degrees or sparks of that consciousness. The form limits what the consciousness can experience and express. And in that way, moving through all of the kingdoms of great nature, there is an entity, there is a degree of intelligence whether it's the globe itself, whether it is a mineral, a grain of sand, whether it's an element, vegetation of any kind, animal forms of any kind. The difference is that over 18 million years ago, when that life force, that soul, that entity of expression moved into the human state, the conditions of the human state allow for an expression, as my cohort said, of mind, spirit, of physicality, astral, however you want to envision that. But in this state, self-consciousness can be achieved. We have the ability to practice metacognition. We have the ability to live a day of life and then sit in reflection at the end of the day and analyze the cycles that existed, see where there was passivity and activity, to understand the triggers that may have gotten us off a philosophical path into a purely personal, emotional path. That self-consciousness is a degree of intelligence that is not yet possible in the lower kingdoms, but potentially it is one and the same.
So the mineral, the vegetable, and the animal, which are all part of our nature, we are not animals because we have manas, which is mind. The mind principle is active, it's active to a degree in the animal, don't get me wrong, and it's all throughout nature. But when we look at the mineral, if we strike a rock, we'll see a spark. Well, that's the spark of intelligence latent within the rock, and cohesion is its cohesion is its force, which is very important. We need cohesion. As someone in Florida with the sinkholes that keep opening up, it's good to be on bedrock. So then we have the vegetable, we have the sensation, which of course we have too. And we see the way that the vegetables, and especially most like the sunflower, we see it most dramatically, how the sunflower follows the sun. It has sensation. It's getting what it needs. It's getting what it needs from the soil and the minerals as well. So it has the lower kingdoms. It's connected to the lower kingdoms. The animal, we have locomotion. And in the human, we have self-choice. And then here we are. We have, and we are here to try to raise up all of nature and to perfect ourselves so that someday we can move on and then be working with another humanity and their struggles to learn and adapt.
A question for the first speaker. It was something along the lines of we heard the first emanation or the first differentiation in this beginning universal idea of cycles, and it was corresponded to the individual, that he can do the exact same thing or has access to the same thing. And we were wondering, in what sense would he use that?
Repeat that again, because I'm trying to reconstruct.
Yeah, so in the first few sentences or minute or two, it was said something along the line of, at the beginning of a cycle with the first emanation. And then it was said the human being has every moment of our day, we have access to that same ability or that same power, that same something corresponds to that. So what do we do with that? What's it made of? And how can we use it to serve?
I guess the thought was that in the early dawn of a day, when we're just becoming aware of existence as we begin to awaken. We are in existence, we are in that nebulous state that is a reflection of the abstract, of a universal. And that coming forth from that state, we mentally, or by the ideas we generate, the memories we hold, we begin to get more and more and more involved, literally, into the physicality of our daily life. But that lesson of abstract existence that we experience in that just the first rousing of awakening versus possibly even anxiety, all the busyness of thought that comes as we truly wake up into this particular day for this incarnation. That is an analogy in some ways for what comes forth in the absolute and evolves through different stages and gradually evolves into the complex manifestation that we're aware of in the rest of the expression of that period of time.
Sounds good to me. The emanations, are we... Could you repeat the question again?
That's why we're asking.
Right, yeah, okay.
Yes, there was a correspondence that was made between the universal first differentiation and something that is available to man at the beginning of whatever cycle, such as...
Okay. Well, we're very fortunate because we have those beings from other rounds that come. They're like gods. They're looked upon as gods, the progenitors, the initiates, the great hierophants, the teachers that instruct us in all our arts and sciences and impress on us all the knowledge that we need to know. And then when we've learned all the lessons, they leave the scene. But just like, and then periodically a great teacher comes along to get us back on in line, get us back on the path, those that are receptive. But what always happens is then we forget. We say, what did they say? We try to codify it, and then it gets all garbled. It becomes, you know, like the Tower of Babel. It becomes all, and then we have, unfortunately, we have the main source of wars in the foreseeable past has been, you know, over religion, over little picayune things that really shouldn't matter, because the one great theosophic religion, the one wisdom religion, which was and is universal and eternal, but it needs to be re-promulgated, because as we fall into matter, we become just so enamored with it and enamored with our powers that we act against our own best interest and the interest of others. We become separative. But we're fortunate that we live in a country where these ideas can be openly discussed and considered. So very fortunate.
From my understanding, we are created from the same substance as that one universal intelligence, from the same stuff as that. Just as our bodies are part and parcel, part of the vegetable, the mineral, the animal, and based off our forms that we have right here, we can do just as that, based off our karma, our will to do the same things, because we're all in potential, have that same power. So that's how I kind of look at this whole thing. And this is what we're learning. When we go with that karma, based off our karma, and we go to that next lifetime, we see what we did, we reap that benefit, we see it, we'll see this is what is suggested for us to do. This is what's planned out. Because we based off our level or of attainment, we can choose what we want, but most, from what I understand, we cannot, because we're limited. You know, maybe at a master level, we can choose where we want to go, but But in the in our next lifetime, we're shown the parents, we're shown the situation, we agree with it, we sign off on it, then we forget. We forget.
Right. And yes, we do.
We forget what those things are, but then there are some certain signs or certain things that are right there in front of us that will show us the way to get there. So that's how I kind of look at it from the student question. Because he's trying to he hit that question, and I had to hear it three times for him to understand what he was saying as well.
The moment of choice is a very interesting concept, and one which invites a lot of individual study and shared study as well. Because if we are indeed dynamos as soul living through the human state, then the thoughts that we generate and hold and add force to, the emotions that we get lost in, those little moments of choice across the duration of an incarnation have tremendous impact. We don't have to wait for some momentous choice at the end of a life or in the face of tremendous tragedy or some explosive moment of some kind. No, it's in the individual moments of life, the individual choice to use our potential for the better, not the dearer, to energize and empower all of life. It's in those moments that we actually begin the karmic weight, literally, of making the big, big choices. And the good fortune about being in the death and rebirth cycle of the human state is that we're not in this alone. We get to learn vicariously. How many times have we looked at public figures and said, oh my gosh, what in the world is so-and-so thinking? Or how can that possibly be? And in our struggle to find the divine in each and all, we begin to learn, wow, look at that choice. Gee, this could have happened if that had been done. And this entire process of dynamics is really key and very, very crucial.
Yes, and so when these ideas became public again, after an absence of many, many centuries throughout the Dark Ages, they came at a pivotal time because the Industrial Revolution was really in full swing. I mean, especially with the use of steam and electricity was coming out at the same time. So we live in a very materialistic... These ideas came to a society of warring and trading people, let's be honest. And so there's all this tumult, there's all this materialism. It's that we needed, and there's... Religion was materialized, science was materialized, even to the point where they used to think that the molecules and atoms were like little billiard balls. And so these ideas are sorely needed because civilization could have collapsed under its weight. And civilizations do rise and fall. We will see, I mean, maybe not in this life, but this civilization will certainly pass away and be replaced by something else. Mm-hmm. But these ideas are eternal, and there are always the knowers who keep this vouchsafed. So,
what's interesting about the modern theosophical movement, and frequently as Westerners, like it or not, everyone in this room is a Westerner. And our education has turned our focus on a Judeo-Christian, Euro-centered kind of impact. So when we talk about the modern Dark Ages, we're referring to Europe, forgetting that in these wonderful cycles of expression of civilization, while Europe was in degradation And while the West is still rising out of that state of ignorance and out of that state of degradation, there were other civilizations in high cycles where this wisdom, and in fact the arts, the sciences, music, etc., were preserved and were celebrated. So, you know, we need to step out sometimes of our Eurocentric cycles or our Western cycles that we've all been influenced by and look, step back and look at the fact that the modern theosophical movement, in part, had an emphasis on wake up West, look to the East, look to the Middle East, look to North Africa, look to Asia, and find the ancients, the ancestors, and what philosophy and religion and science they protected and preserved during these dark ages.
This young man had his hand up.
Yes. considering we are in the dark age and the comment that was made that it encourages rapid change, my question would be along of the lines of, according to the cyclic law and periodicity, where does ascendance come into play?
Where does
ascendance come into play?
Ascendance, because of we know that these cycles, I don't know how, if they stop or not, and ascendance comes into play. So that's kind of my question. You can reconstruct it as you understand it.
Wow.
What does ascendance mean?
Ascendance. Well, let's get an idea of what ascendance means. It means rising. We rise each day, and if we meditate and concentrate, we can help raise up our. We have plenty of time. We don't worry about the clock. It's just an illusion. But so we are in a state of ascendance. We involute to a point, to the turning point, and then we evolute. So we may take two steps backwards and one step forward sometimes, but then we may take the next day two steps forward and just one step backwards. We are always, as long as we keep up the struggle, we are ascending. The moment of choice was mentioned earlier, and that is when, that's not until the middle of the next round, which is billions of years into the future, so we don't really need to worry about that now. But we are always making these choices, and there will come a point where some of humanity will have to be left behind. They'll get other chances, but they'll be holding us back, or hopefully us. You know, we can't be presumptuous. Well, that group will be holding back and retarding the evolution of those that are on their ways to becoming a race of adepts and masters and enlightened beings. So ascendance is a process. It seems very slow. It doesn't seem very dramatic usually, but it's a process. Mm.
The dark age that was being spoken of is the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age. And that's an interesting topic to research in terms of Hindu legends and information. But it stands to reason that in an Iron Age, if we just use iron as a substance and we think about the smelting process from which iron is turned into steel, and we think about the heat, what happens in that heating process of the iron being purified and the steel emerging is more and more molecular activity, more and more pressure, more and more friction. And so in some ways, that's an analogy for the Kali Yuga age. With heat, with friction, with force comes pressure, and that will seem like speed in a certain way, okay? So in that time period, in the Kali Yuga, all soul is experiencing the pressure cooker of life and the development of life, but each of us can step back out of that? How many times have we been in the workplace where we're watching two managers argue back and forth, or an employee disgruntled over in the corner fighting with a manager, and we realize if they would both calm down and bring the force down, bring the tone down, slow it down, take away the heat, they'd have an easier time of comparing ideas and coming to a new solution. So the ascendancy is moment by moment the choice being made to stay as calm as possible, to stay as observant as possible, and in the process of observing and thinking about how could something better benefit another, we are transmuting all of the forces at our avail. We may not be aware of it in our waking hours. We may not have the immediate gratification of seeing the results of what we're doing, but we rest assured that in the cycles of birth, death, rebirth, no effort is ever lost, and the ascendancy across time comes. In terms of the statement about some human beings will be left behind in development, each of us is on a self-fulfilled, a self-devised path. Abraham Maslow talked about the self-actualizing human being. So we're each in a creative venture, building and designing a future of ascendancy or not. That's true. But for those who really make a study of this, the notion of universal brotherhood, the notion of service and altruism on behalf of the others, means that as each of us takes a step, we may see something a little clearer. It's up to us to reach behind and make the offer to someone who knows less to be more enlightened, just as we would turn to someone who has greater wisdom and we would help for help from them.
Well, I would, in closing, we would like to mention that we have an ocean class on Wednesday evenings. Okay. Just a reminder, it begins at 7:30 and ends at 8:30. And what's the topic?
Next Wednesday is Dreams and the Dreamer.
Dreams and the Dreamer.
Oh, next Sunday.
Next Sunday is Dreams Sunday. And the Dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting topic. And we wanted to just quickly say that another word for ascendancy is evolution. And evolution is the pivotal doctrine. That is where, you know, if it wasn't for evolution, that everything would, you know, nothing can remain static, really. So, but through evolution, we find ascendance. And we found a wonderful reading from the Bhagavad Gita, which is Krishna, the higher self, speaking to Arjuna, who are ourselves, who don't realize we are that higher self also, under most circumstances. And we think this ties everything together. I am the father and mother of this universe, the grandsire and preserver. I am the origin and dissolution, the receptacle, the storehouse, and the eternal seed. I cause light and heat and rain. I am death and immortality. I am the cause unseen and the visible effect. Subtle perception, spiritual knowledge, right judgment, patience, truth, self-mastery, pleasure and pain, prosperity and adversity, birth and death, danger and security, fear and equanimity, satisfaction, restraint of body and mind, almsgiving and offensiveness, zeal and glory, and ignominy. All these various dispositions of creatures come from me. I am the ego which is seated in the heart of all beings. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all existing things. I am endless time itself and the preserver whose face is turned on all sides. I am all-grasping death and the birth of those who are to be. Meeting is adjourned. That's over.